From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. North Carolina's gas tax is losing its effectiveness as a tool for funding state transportation projects. You'll learn why. You'll also learn about a controversial alternative. Some state lawmakers are studying possible splits of larger school systems. You'll hear highlights from their first discussion of the idea. Legislators also want a better sense of how much money local systems need to upgrade their school buildings. A recent study highlighted needs in some of the state's poorest districts. Plus, we'll highlight sales tax measures on the election ballot in at least a dozen North Carolina counties. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Every parent wants, and in fact expects, to have an effective, qualified teacher leading their child's classroom. Here in North Carolina, a number of our universities actually have education schools where they train future teachers. The UNC system recently evaluated the training provided by those schools. Dr. Terry Stoops of the John Locke Foundation believes that that evaluation fell short. He joins us now to talk about it. Terry, of course, is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies for the Locke Foundation. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk first about the genesis of the UNC Systems report. Evidently, they were looking at our performance, kids' performance on federal tests, and they wanted to see why we were falling behind in some cases.
Yes, research tells us that the most important factor a school-based factor that contributes to the academic performance of a child is the teacher and teacher quality. So this has been something that's been on the radar, especially the UNC system, for, as I noted in my piece that talked about this UNC report, for about 100 years now we've been worried about teacher quality. And for about that same 100 years, we've had the same approach to the way that we train teachers, not completely similar, but a lot of the same structures and approaches that we have today would be very similar to what we've seen 50, 60, 70 years ago. So this is the latest in an ongoing effort to try to look at the way we train teachers in the UNC system and think and consider whether there are better models to train teachers, to consider whether we are doing a good job training teachers, and whether changes need to be done to the way we train teachers in the UNC system.
Before we get into your views on that, let's let our listeners know about these teacher education schools in particular. I mean, how important are they to actually making sure that we have enough teachers in our state?
Well, it's pretty complicated because if you look at the number of teachers that teach right now in the system, in the public school system in North Carolina, it only represents about 37% are coming from the UNC system. So that means that a whole bunch of teachers are coming from other places. They're coming from out of state. They're coming from other types of programs that train them, called lateral entry programs, where adults can go back and get their teaching credential. They come from the Teach for America, visiting international faculty. So it's a really complex matter to talk about teacher quality in North Carolina because you're not only talking about the UNC system training teachers, but you're talking about teachers trained in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and New York who come to North Carolina simply because there are very few jobs in those states for teachers, and so they come here in pursuit of a teaching career. So we have to be mindful that when we talk about reforms to the UNC system, they're only going to go so far in helping us to improve the quality of teachers in our public schools.
And in fact, based on that, that's one of the reasons that you believe that the UNC system's evaluation of their teacher training schools really fell short a bit.
That's right, because when you look at what kind of education is provided from the UNC system schools, you find a great deal of variation, first of all. You have some teacher education programs in UNC system schools, most notably UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, Appalachian, and a few other schools that are doing a pretty good job of training teachers. And then you have some schools that are not doing such a great job. So you have a great deal of variability within the teacher education programs themselves. But you also have to look at what kind of teachers we're getting from some of these other areas. And fortunately, we have research that shows us how these teachers perform, the teachers that come from the UNC system compared to where they're coming from elsewhere. And so we can compare the quality of teachers that we're getting from these various sources.
In fact, in your writing about this, you focus in on two particular programs that are outside the UNC system, one of them being Teach for America, the other Visiting International Faculty. Tell us about those programs and then how they do compare to folks who are educated within the UNC system.
What Teach for America does is to take college graduates, typically those who do not have an education degree, and they sign them up for a 2-year stint in a low-income and or low-performing school. And these students are usually high-performing students that graduate from typically prestigious universities, but they just don't have the credentials to go into the teaching profession. And so they sign up for Teach for America. They have to go through a rigorous screening process. And if they make it through, they go through a equally rigorous training process before they enter these schools and become teachers. Visiting International Faculty has a model of looking at those who have teaching degrees from universities abroad and bringing them to the United States for up to 5 years to teach in our public schools. Their visa will only allow them to stay for 5 years. And they are placed in elementary, middle, and high schools, just like Teach for America teachers, but it's time limited in a very similar way. And it's worth noting that there's a very rigorous screening process for these teachers as well. So there's a lot of similarities between the Visiting International Faculty and the Teach for America teachers. And probably the biggest similarity, of course, is that they're not trained in teacher education programs here in North Carolina.
What do we know about those two programs in particular in terms of the effectiveness of the teachers, of the quality of the teachers, as compared to those folks who are trained within the UNC system?
Well, research has been conducted over the last few years to compare how teachers trained in these various other places are performing compared to UNC trained teachers shows that Visiting International Faculty and Teach for America teachers are outperforming all of their peers, those trained in the UNC system, those trained from out of state, and those are trained from alternative or so-called lateral entry programs. So by far, the highest performing teachers that we have in North Carolina are coming from these two programs that are outside of the UNC system. Now, I do want to mention that it's a rather small number of teachers that are enrolled in Teach for America and the Visiting International Faculty programs. But when you look at student test score growth, they are by far the top teachers in the state.
It seems then that the UNC system would look to those two programs to say, hey, what are they doing that we're not doing that appears to be leading to a higher performance?
You would hope that that would be the approach, is to look to see where the best teachers are coming from and then find ways to get individuals like that into our public schools. And I think to a certain extent that's been done in the General Assembly, and certainly Governor McCrory were looking at ways to get highly qualified individuals into the classroom. In Governor McCrory's case, for example, it was military, those who had been discharged from the military and were looking to transfer into the public school system as a change in career. Troops to teachers is what that
right.
is called. So looking at alternative routes for individuals to get into the teaching profession. One of the distinctive things about Visiting International Faculty, about Teach for America, is their rigorous screening process. It's very difficult to get into Teach for America. It's very difficult to get into a teacher education program abroad because they are much more selective in who they choose to go into these professions. And so they screen out a lot of the individuals that really shouldn't be in the classroom and are really doing a disservice to kids. And the same is the approach in other areas as well, looking at not only how they screen teachers, but how they train them to make sure that they are have a good skill set in knowing the subject matter for which they're teaching. In other words, the emphasis is not so much on the pedagogy, you know, the way that you learn how to teach. It is on what you teach. And I think that's probably the way that we need to approach teacher education in North Carolina going forward.
Dr. Terry Stoops, he is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Education Studies, also the Vice President for Research. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us, much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina's gas tax will be a dead duck in the not-too-distant future. Our next guest delivered that message recently to state legislators. Adrian Moore is Vice President of Policy at the Libertarian Reason Foundation. He joins us now to explain what that means and why state lawmakers should be thinking now about alternative ways to pay for transportation needs. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
So the gas tax is something that North Carolina has relied on for a long time to deal with major transportation needs. But you say that not too far in the future, maybe not next year or the next 5 years, right, but not too far down the line, it's not going to be delivering what it has for years and years.
Yeah, I mean, we're already seeing that, and it's not just in North Carolina. Fuel efficiency is getting better all the time for everything. Even, you know, look at pickups. I mean, I can remember when a pickup that got 10 miles to the gallon was a miracle, you know, and now old pickups can get 10 miles to the gallon. So the technology is changing, and the industry is out there trying to figure out how to get even more. Electric vehicles are, you know, we're trying to figure out how to make electric vehicles actually really work for people in, you know, in real life, in a sense, not just at sort of at the margins. And hybrid vehicles have already achieved, you know, this amazing fuel economy, which is great in a lot of ways, but it is a challenge for the people who have to pay for the roads and the infrastructure, because hybrids use just as much road as a non-hybrid. A Toyota Prius and a Toyota Camry use the same amount of road, but the amount of gas tax they pay is very, very different. And so we see a lot of states, and we see North Carolina is seeing a decline in gas tax revenues, while there's an increase in using the roadway system. And 10 years from now, when that problem is considerably worse than it is now, it's not obvious that the gas tax will still be an effective user fee mechanism to pay for the roads, which is what it has been to date. So a lot of states are starting to look at what's a new user fee we can adopt to replace the gas tax.
And during your presentation to legislators, you basically told them that there are two ways of going about this. One is you try to find another user fee, or you just throw up your hands and say, we can't do that anymore, have to pay for these needs out of the general fund.
Right. And that really is largely what it comes down to. We can buy some time and a little bit of wiggle room with some indirect fees. I mean, you know, imagine we pay a vehicle fee, we pay a driver's license fee, you know, we pay a tax on the tires we buy, things like that. Those add to the Department of Transportation's revenues to pay for the system, but they're relatively small compared to the fuel tax. And they're also not as flexible. I mean, if you got rid of the gas tax and you wanted to make that up with your vehicle fee or your license fee, you'd be talking about people having to pay hundreds of dollars more, if in some cases maybe thousands more, not a very palatable option for folks. So, and those things are not really directly related to use, because if I have to pay a vehicle fee for buying a Toyota Camry, just to stick with that example, and I'm going to drive 4,000 miles because I live 2 miles from work and I just don't, you know, I don't have kids in soccer or anything like that. It's just me and the wife. And that's, I pay the same fee as someone who drives 20,000 miles because my job, I've got a sales job and I have to drive around to all the different cities in my region of North Carolina. And yet they both pay the same fee. So it would be a lot less fair if we went to that system. So the two options that are generally considered to be fair and economically efficient at this point is a user fee not based on gas but based on how many miles you drive. So directly paying for using the road basically, or you just go to general revenue and every year the transportation budget has to fight for funds against the school budget and everything else. There's no longer any connection between what we pay and how much we use the system, which has some real disadvantages.
We are chatting with Adrian Moore, who's Vice President of Policy at the Libertarian Reason Foundation. The crux of your presentation was really about, okay, the mileage-based user fee. If we're right. going to go, if we're going to change, we've got to find something that's an alternative to the gas tax, but it's still a user fee. And you discussed the fact that there's already some work being done on this. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so if we're going to replace the gas tax with something else, we have to do – basically, we have to do pilot projects to figure out what that is. And the candidate that everybody's looking at these days and for which there are a good dozen pilots going on is a mileage-based fee. So I was actually asked to talk about how do you do a pilot project on that? What do we know from all that experience about how to do this? And I made a couple of points. One, I said, look, you want to set up your pilot project to investigate the things that people are worried about. So people are worried about privacy. They don't want a system that's going to track them. So make sure your pilot includes a way to address that. And as most of pilots have, there's always options where nobody, where you don't get tracked. So people have a choice to do that. You know, it costs, rural versus urban equity and things like that. Build that into your pilot. And also have all the people who are going to be active in this decision participate. Have legislators participate, reporters participate, people from the industry, taxpayer groups, people from John Locke, folks like that. Have them all participate so they can talk about it from firsthand knowledge.
From the work that's already been done on this, have we seen some positive signs on a mileage-based fee, or is it still something that's very early on and we don't really know how it's going to work?
It's still pretty early. I mean, we've had enough pilots completed to know that it's at least possible. It's possible to do it. It's possible to do it in ways where people have choices that are completely private. It's possible to do it with lots of different technologies. What we haven't addressed are some of the tricky things like people who cross the state border as part of their, you know, day-to-day or week-to-week normal travel. How do we keep the costs down because it's relatively expensive? So it's got a ways to go. But the thing is you can't wait. You've got to do these pilot projects over the next 10 years so that 10 years from now you're not sitting there with nothing when the gas tax really, really starts to run out.
You mentioned that one state in particular on the other side of the country is kind of at least several years along the way here and ramping up to actually replacing its gas tax.
Yeah, that's Oregon. They were the first state to really get serious about doing pilot projects, and they've finished their pilot projects and are now on a slow and gradual process of replacing, moving people into this system rather than the gas tax. And that's kind of, I think, a crucial point is, you know, a lot of people worry, well, wait, they're just going to start charging me per mile and I'll still have to pay the gas tax unless I buy an electric car. And so a key part of the system is it has to actually be a replacement for the gas tax.
I would assume, based on what you've said, that your key recommendation to lawmakers in this state is
do something of a pilot. Don't just sit back and say it's going to solve itself.
Yeah, start doing a pilot. There's right now the federal government is providing matching funds for doing these pilots, so it's a good time to get started because you can save the state taxpayer some money by getting some federal funding for it. And start to answer people's questions and figure out – either find out this thing isn't going to work and start working on plan B, or figure out that it will work and start figuring out how do we create a system that everybody can live with.
One person who will be watching this process closely is Adrian Moore, Vice President of Policy at the Libertarian Reason Foundation. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokine. Should North Carolina's largest school districts be split up? It's a topic state lawmakers are considering. Republican Representative Bill Brawley explains.
This committee will be studying a question that comes up from time to time. There are debates in several counties on whether the school systems are too large and whether or not they should be broken up. Those debates tend to go primarily on the basis of opinion, not fact. The purpose of this committee is to study that issue and generate some facts to inform the debate as it goes forward. The report we will produce will be intended to clarify the data on the questions we will be discussing. I have been asked numerous times if we will be generating a bill to break up insert school system here. We do not intend to generate bills to break up specific school systems, and I doubt if we will have enough data at the end of this short process to even generate a procedure. but we do intend to inform the debate, clarify the issues that need to be addressed, because I do not see this debate going away. There is discussions now within Mecklenburg County, within Wake County, within Rowan County, within other counties, on are the school system structures still relevant to the society we have today. The intent of this committee is not to take precipitate action. This is a process that needs to be examined deliberately, and actions that are taken in the future need to be based upon fact and not opinion. And it is the intent of this chair that our report will clarify the debate, identify issues that need to be resolved, and either confirm or refute some of the observations that are being made today.
Democratic Senator Joyce Waddell responded to Brawley's opening statement.
I listened to the clarity that you discussed as the purpose of this committee, and I'm hoping that we will hold to that and the community will not feel that they have been blindsided or that something else came as a result. I want us to be succinct, transparent, and hold to what we say we're going to do as the purpose of the committee.
Senator, I appreciate your comments, and I would agree with them, because if we come out of this process with a feeling on anyone's part that they were blindsided or not dealt with in good faith, I don't see how we could go forward with something that would be useful in improving the educational results for our children.
That's State Representative Bill Brawley. He's leading a committee studying ways large school systems could be split in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we do. And that's not bluster. In a private survey of more than 250 North Carolina political insiders, 87% said we influence them either a great deal or a good amount. So while others talk and complain, we get to work providing research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse that is the envy of every other state. Our research has actually helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, and improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. The John Locke Foundation, we're dedicated to making North Carolina first in freedom. We're dedicated to you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. State lawmakers have been trying to gauge how much money local school systems need for up-to-date school buildings. One way they've tackled the issue, a recent report from the MGT Consulting Group. It focused on 9 mostly low-wealth school systems. Edward Humble of MGT spelled out the bottom line.
The total for those 9 districts that we came up with was over $630 million. The largest single of those was Harnett County at 239. Shouldn't be a surprise. They were the largest district. They had the most number of buildings. They are a pretty rapidly growing county. So that shouldn't surprise any of us. Maybe another way to look at it is what were the greatest needs if we divided it by the dollars they needed per student in that district, because we had a wide range of variety of size of districts. When we looked at that, the two highest were Anson and Jones County, which was 37,000 and 34, almost 35,000 respectively in those two counties on a dollar needed per student. Okay. The average need for all 9 districts was 18,000. So those two had a much higher need on a per student basis as one way to look at that.
Humble also looked at the impact for local property taxes.
The districts that would require the highest tax rate to meet this facility needs, what the tax rate would need to be under current regulations in the state of current possibilities for raising capital dollars in the state of North Carolina. Anson, Birdie, Jones, and Scotland would all have to have a tax rate of over $1.05. I want to just point out that statewide, the average tax rate is 66 cents statewide. Okay. The average tax rate in these nine counties, remember these were primarily low wealth counties, so the average tax rate in theirs, in those nine, in these nine counties is 90 cents. It would be up over $1.05 in those, in the four that I pointed out here. Quite frankly, as you might guess, you know, we didn't see a lot of appetite for those kinds of tax rates in low wealth counties. We didn't see that, but that under the current methodology for funding capital, that's what it would require.
Humble and his team reached some conclusions that might help North Carolina legislators.
The first thing is, you know, as you know, the majority of capital funding in North Carolina comes from local property tax revenue. In fact, by statute in North Carolina, it says that it's the counties, that capital construction is the responsibility of the county. Okay, there was a capital need in identified in every district, and I believe that would extrapolate to every county in the state of North Carolina. And in fact, this study asked us to look at low wealth districts, and is there a difference? Yes. Right now they are paying a higher than average tax rate, and in order to meet their needs, it would be significantly higher in most of those districts. So yes, the answer to that question that we were asked to look at is yes.
That's Edward Humble of MGT Consulting Group. He's spelling out details of a recent report on North Carolina's school building funding needs. That report includes recommendations for state lawmakers.
The first one is the short-term recommendation, is that we think that the state of North Carolina needs to look at a systematic review of school facility need survey. It's right now, the DPI works hard and asks for self-reporting. Self-reporting is, at best, a very inconsistent tool. You're not going to have any kind of consistency with which to make decisions, which makes sense because the law right now is that its capital is the responsibility of the local county and local county commissioners. But if we're going to look at any other ways, if we're going to look at some other ways to fund capital needs for schools in the state of North Carolina, we need to have a more consistent methodology.
That's the short-term recommendation. There are other ideas North Carolina could pursue.
We think even under the current rules of it's the county's responsibility, that is there a potential to establish a long-term revolving fund account at the state level. There are some states that have done this, that local counties can borrow against at maybe a reduced interest rate. Maybe it is based on what your wealth is in your county, but that they can borrow against that in order to be able to meet this needs. Is that in some states are in fact doing that. Are there, we think the state should look at some alternative funding sources. And that, again, I can't stand up and tell you what in North Carolina that would be. I can give you examples of what other states have done, okay? State of Georgia has been very successful with what they call SPLOST, Special Purpose Local Option Sales Taxes, that a local county can levy sales tax in order to use for some specific purposes, one of the major ones being capital construction of school facilities, okay? The state of Colorado has dedicated a lot of their resource revenue and created a state agency called the BEST Board, which stands for Building Excellent Schools Today, and they then allocate the money from those resources. So are there some alternative ways for the state of North Carolina? Because the way it is right now, it's very difficult, especially in these low-wealth counties, to be able to meet the need. Then again, a consistent methodology for determining the need. It kind of goes back to that short-term one. Let's figure out how we would do that, and then let's put that in place as a consistent way so that you know. Because whatever way that you might want to look at this, and whichever way, whether you use a model like Georgia or a model like Colorado or whatever you might want to do, whichever way you look at it, in order to allocate funds, you're going to need to have some consistent way to say, yes, the need in this county is this and the need in this county is this, and that's based on a fair and consistent methodology across the state.
And a key component for North Carolina, as with every other place, is setting priorities.
I always like to say that we do this kind of work all over the country. In fact, in many places around the world, I'm still waiting for the place that we do this kind of work and we find more money than needs. Haven't found it yet. Don't think I'm going to find it in North Carolina. I've given up, actually. We actually did a long-term facility master plan for the United Arab Emirates. And we thought that, you know, they're building islands out in the Gulf and all that. We thought that we gave them the final report. They looked at us and said, this is great, great information, what we wanted. We can't afford this. So I decided I'm never going to find the place that has more money than needs. And so, therefore, we have to have a system of prioritization. And that's going to need to take into account a lot of different factors. Obviously, the need. Obviously, the ability for that local county to be able to fund that need.
Republican State Representative Craig Horn of Union County co-chairs the committee that heard Humble's report. He sees some big issues for his colleagues to address.
There is that question of role of the state versus local role of the counties. We heard about the comment on tax capacity. What we have not yet received and will be and has yet not been made available to these districts, this information in detail. And that's going to be made available to them so that they can respond, which would maybe perhaps enlighten us and indicate what future action would be appropriate for the General Assembly. I don't need to tell you the impact of these recommendations and more particularly the impact of the needs that are obviously pointed out. But I am suggesting that this is complex.
That's State Representative Craig Horn responding to a recent report suggesting hundreds of millions of dollars worth of school facility needs in just 9 of North Carolina's 100 counties. Lawmakers are looking at whether the state needs to change the way it pays for those school buildings. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored 2 members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. This May's election ballot in at least 12 North Carolina counties will ask voters to decide yes or no to raising the sales tax rate by a quarter cent. Question is, what for? Particularly since voters have previously said no to the question. Julie Tisdale is the John Locke Foundation City and County Policy Analyst. She joins us now to talk about the ballot situation. Julie, welcome back.
Thank you, Don.
If my math is correct, roughly 2/3 of North Carolina counties have at one point or another over the last decade or so put this question on the ballot. So how has it turned out?
More often than not, it is rejected. So you're right, 68 counties have put it on the ballot at some point. But that's 127 times that it's been on the ballot, because in many of these counties, it's been on more than once. Only 31 have ever passed it. So it fails a lot more often than it succeeds.
But county officials are persistent. They want that money.
They are persistent. Some of them have had it on the ballot as many as 5 times.
Wow.
Some that are that have it on the ballot this year just had it rejected 2 years ago. So they keep coming back to try to get that quarter cent.
How is it that they actually have the authority to do this? Because folks might not understand that they do have to have specific authority to even ask voters about this.
Right. The legislature gave that authority in 2007. It's blanket authority. Any county can put this vote, can put this sales tax increase on the ballot for voters to sort of make a choice about. It is only a quarter cent, and you can only do it once. You can't kind of a quarter cent and then another quarter cent and then another quarter cent and let it build. So there's a special provision that allows counties to do this, and then they can use that revenue for whatever they want to use it for. It is not specific to a particular purpose.
We know in North Carolina, coming up in just a few weeks in May, we have a primary election, and so far, your analysis shows that at least a dozen North Carolina counties are going to ask voters this question. Where is this going to take place?
This is in right across the state. So it's in large counties, small counties, east to west. But yeah, there are 12 so far that we know about.
Could be more.
Could be more. Not all the counties have published their ballots yet. And there is no central location where all of that information is collected. And so we're still exploring that. We're still looking at county board of election sites, trying to find those ballots and make sure we've got the most up-to-date information. But as of right now, we know of at least 12.
Julie, do we have any idea among the dozen counties what the justification will be? Have they given voters any sense of here's why we, quote, need this?
So the legislation specifically prohibits them from putting any of that on the ballot, and they can't tie themselves to any purpose. That said, most of the time the county will come out and say, we want this because. And usually it will come as no surprise to most of your listeners. Usually the justification is schools. We need this for the children. We need this for investment in school buildings or tech or other kind of school supplies. Most of these 12 are saying it's for schools. There are a couple of exceptions. Rockingham County is looking to sort of expand a workforce development center at the community college. There's another county that's looking at volunteer fire departments. But most of the time, they're saying that they're going to spend it for schools. But they don't have to. After it passes, they can use it however they want.
And Julie, we should be clear for our listeners that you're not advocating that people vote for this or vote against it. What you're wanting people to do is really to become more informed about what their local governments are doing with money.
Right. And I want people to think about the implications of this, because it sounds like a great way to raise revenue, but this is not a tax that's applied evenly across the state. So it's possible that a county raises its sales tax and has a whole bunch of neighbors that have not raised theirs. That makes you the high tax, expensive jurisdiction in the area, and that can really hurt local businesses. So while this sounds like something that would raise a little bit of revenue, isn't really going to hurt that much, it's just a quarter cent, it actually, A, can really add up to some significant money. I mean, it's a quarter cent, but people clip coupons for a quarter all the time.
I do.
Right. So those pennies matter and they add up, and people it really does affect family household budgets. And also it can really hurt businesses if you become less competitive than the counties around you.
In fact, you have been writing about a couple of different research studies on these very issues. Tell us a little bit more about those studies.
So there are several, but all of these studies reach very similar conclusions. And that is that people will cross borders in order to save money on the sales tax and other sorts of taxation. Now, the larger the distances are and the smaller the cost of the item, the less people will do that. So that's pretty intuitive. You might drive 100 miles to buy a car in a lower tax area. You're not going to drive 100 miles to buy a gallon of milk. So clearly there is some – it depends a little bit on what sorts of items we're talking about. It also depends on how close you live to that line. But there are lots of people that live in one county, work in another. They're in both counties every day. And so people in that kind of situation, the evidence seems to show, will adjust their buying patterns to shop in the lower tax jurisdiction.
Julie, when it comes to sales tax, I'll just say for myself, I don't even look at the receipt. Frankly, I don't even know what the rate is in my particular county. And shame on me for not knowing that. But am I reflective of most people?
So yes, that is the case. I mean, people over time, the other thing the study shows is that over time, the effects diminish because people just sort of recognize that this is just kind of the cost of buying things. It's just sort of part of the deal. But that said, people may start to recognize if there's a real difference, and so they become aware of that line. You don't know what it is here, but you might start to recognize if the grocery store 2 miles east is consistently that little bit cheaper than the grocery store 2 miles west. And that may be related to the sales tax.
The one place that I do notice it from county to county is if I buy the same like sub sandwich at a lunch shop,
right?
And it costs a particular amount in one area, and then you go to the very same shop but in a different county, and it costs just a little bit more.
Right.
It makes you wonder, but that's a good way to compare.
Right. And particularly for big ticket items where people shop around, you know, again, it's probably not going to affect where you buy your gallon of milk. But what these, what the research shows is that particularly for larger ticket items, for major appliances, that sort of thing, people are much more aware of those differences. And so it can really hurt businesses in those sectors.
In fact, Julie, I believe in some of your writings and some of the research you've looked at, it talks about the potential for long-term and really negative impacts on the economy in terms of business and hiring. Tell us a little bit more about that.
So there were a couple of studies. Let me just check those details. There was a study out of the national that was published in the National Tax Journal in 2012 that showed a significant impact on employment, payroll, and hiring. I think the most worrying thing there was that a 1 percentage point increase in the sales tax led to a decrease in retail employment of up to 7.5%.
That's
huge. A huge impact in employment in particular sectors. It's not right across the economy, but in those sectors of retail employment, there's a really big hit. There was a recent study out of the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, and it showed very similar kinds of results. It also showed that there was a real spike in online shopping when the sales tax increased, people trying to avoid paying those taxes.
Interesting. Yeah. And it's all about being an informed voter when
Absolutely.
You go into that ballot box. Julie Tisdale's report on this at johnlock.org. The headline, The Perils of Increasing Local Sales Taxes. Julie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll come back again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlock.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlock.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.